You know, as far as the dinner goes, we're going to have, you know, what a time for a social to get together and to be with one another. And you know, somebody said, well, why would we go to a dinner that's going to be about pledge drive? And I thought, you know, a lot of us come to Unitarian Universalist circles, societies, churches, to get away from guilt and shame, religious processes and pressure. And I thought, well, you know, asking my own self, have I got listening to somebody talk about money intertwined with guilt or intertwined with shame or intertwined with aggravation? We certainly don't want people to talk about our money and what we're doing. And then I thought, well, but doesn't that need to become just part of the way and of who we are? Because without our labor and without the offering, money is symbolic of the fruit. And in the olden days, they would bring preachers chickens and fruits and things. And aren't we not doing the same thing? And how can we participate in that process and feel good about it, knowing that what we give, we're building something. We're not giving something to take away from something else. We're actually beginning to intertwine our lives and our stories together in the same story, and we're building something and putting together something that expresses our values in the community. And as I've been in this community for 6 years, I am very clear that in this area, this is a unique building. This is a unique group of people. These values are unique. Although some people might read our values and agree to our values, when we step back and look at the world, we certainly do not see the values of Unitarian Universalisms at the forefront of our culture. But yet, here we are. And so the money is a process of building something. It is a process of creating something. And I hope that's the way we begin to look at this. Pledge drive, and even pledge drive scares me, you know. Pledge drive, I'm not coming to that. But to see the dinner as a celebration and as a social, to get together where we're talking to one another and we're visiting with one another and we're expressing that we are together in this process of bringing a light that does shine on our values in this community. I was watching, was visiting with my mom, and she lives across the street from a ballpark, basketball, tennis from a park, and I was watching five people practice baseball, and it was clearly a team. I mean, you could see it was a team. They had equipment. They had the equipment bags. I don't know where the rest were, but there was a person pitching, batting, and two in the outfield, and there was another person. And as I was watching, remembering my childhood, seeing like baseball and things like that, and how much fun that was. I was watching, there were two people way out in the outfield, and there was one person who was kind of running around to wherever the ball went, and the pitcher was pitching, and the batter was trying as hard as he could to get that ball to those people way out there in the outfield. I mean, and you could tell he was swinging hard. Now, the one person, wherever the ball was hit, would run to and get to the ball, and so he's really exercising himself, and then the guy could hit, but he just couldn't hit it that far. And those people were just standing way back there. Every once in a while, he'd hit a really hard line drive, and it would just go past the infield and hit. And the ball and the people standing, and those two people standing in the outfield would stand there, and the ball would get and dribble up, and they could pick it, and they could throw it back, you know. And I'm going, you know, where's the exercise where you charge the ball coming at you, throw on a run to get the guy, you know, sliding into second or wherever it was. And so watching this and started to get into, and it started amazing because I could tell where the guy was going to hit the ball. And if I'm going to practice in the outfield, I've got to go to where the ball is going to go. I can't stand back here and expect the ball to come to me when I know the ball's not going to come to me, because if you're standing out there for an hour or 45 minutes, you know where that ball is going because it was pretty predictable. And so later on, as they were walking back, walking to the bench, the one guy that was running all over the place, getting the ball, he's getting a drink and sweating like a dog. And the other two said, well, that really wasn't much of a practice, was it? You know, and I thought, maybe this is a bit like church. You know, there's a lot of us standing out there in that outfield waiting for the ball to come to us, but we're not going to where the action is, and there's a few people running around in circles trying to get everything done. But that's where the fun is. That's where the action is. That's where we get better at what we're practicing, is when we move to where the action is. And I thought, how could you say that wasn't a good practice? Because the one guy says, it was a great practice. The others say, no, not at all. And is that like how we are at church? I hate guilt stories, don't you? I just hate them. I just hate them. Recently, we've been talking about giving more money. No, we've been talking about a story for Unitarian Universalism and how we've heard this story throughout the years. We don't know what to say to people when they say, who are you as a Unitarian Universalist? We don't know how to talk to people when they say, you are a Unitarian Universalist. And everybody seems, other religions have something right to say and right to contribute, right to participate with. And we get kind of blocked because when we say, you know, somebody says, are you a Christian? We'll say, well, what do you mean by that? Do you mean a Roman Christian? Or do you mean a first century follower of the teachings of Jesus? Or do you mean a third century Christian? Or do you mean a Gnostic Christian? What do you mean? You know, we want to know, what do you mean? And they say, well, do you believe in God? And we're going, well, what do you mean? What do you mean? What do you mean by God? Do you mean the divine that is within us, that's the light of the world? Do you mean this external being? Do you mean the mother God? Do you mean the father God? Just what do you mean? And, you know, we want an hour conversation just to set up the answer to the question so we know what context we're coming from. And it's true. It's just absolutely true. And that is how we are. And, you know, we're going to do a picnic table and it turns into a conversation. We can go to this table, which is all true. And we need to have that conversation. It is how we are. And so I began to think, we really don't, in talking about myth and story last week, we really don't have a myth or a story for Unitarian Universalism. We'll go back and we'll quote Thoreau, we'll quote Emerson, we'll quote Margaret Fuller, and we'll say this is our story, and we'll go back and get the historical facts. But we don't have a myth that infuses the spirit. And Helen was reading something from Henry David Thoreau this morning. I thought, yeah, that would be a good one to put in the foundation of our story. And see what you think. It says, let your life be a friction against the machines. Yeah, that'd be a good one for us. And then we say, oh no, we're pacifists. You know. So again, the conversation, how do we get principles that support the myth of who we are? And I'm reminded of H. Richard Niebuhr, a theologian in the mid-20th century, and he talked about internal and external histories of faith groups. And he said that each faith group will have an internal history. Each person will have an internal history of who they are, and they will engage other stories, other histories, other faith traditions. And he said it's important for us to maintain our internal history, our story, our tradition, but yet at the same time, it's also important to engage other stories and have a decision-making process. Is there something in that other story that would be helpful to us? Is there something in that other story that might bring light to our story? Is there something in that other story that might actually help us move along our way and for us not to be so arrogant to think our story is the best story and that somebody else couldn't be helpful to who we are? And I'm thinking, well, we need to have the same kind of thing as Unitarian Universalists. We need to have an understanding that we do have a story and we do have a myth. And again, it's not necessarily the truth, the factual truth, you know, but it is truthful. And that's the kind of story we want to have. We want to have a truthful story that carries meaning so that when we're having a conversation with other people, we can say, well, no, this is our story. And I was talking to a minister, friend of mine, and he had a Bible study, and he was doing a book by Marcus Borges, I believe. And in the Bible study, it was a very liberal Bible study, and he had the parishioner, you know, some parishioners around him, and in the Bible study, they did the Lord's Prayer, Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, kingdom, you know, the Lord's Prayer. And he said that this guy suggested we do Our Father and Our Mother. Well, let me tell you, he said half the people didn't come back. It started a fight, and he was praying. Nobody left the church. Nobody left the church. But they're just changing a word in their myth. Just a word in their myth. So then I was telling that story to my stepson, Ian, and he said, well, it doesn't make any difference. It's still patriarchal. You can't just change a word. The whole structure is patriarchal. You got to change the structure. You can't do that. And just went, well, what are you even talking about? And it's true. You can't change a word, or you can't change the content of language. You got to change the process of language. And so that what he was saying, just because you change the word, you have not escaped patriarchy. Just because you change the language or the phrases, you haven't escaped the oppression of patriarchy. And as you remember, last week I said that it was important for us as Unitarian Universalists to somehow convey that there was a pre-patriarchy. There was a human existence and a human experience before society was organized in such a way that it had a hierarchical structure which said some people were better than other people, and the people who have the most are the best, and they get to have served, the other people get to serve them. Patriarchy is the kind of model that you have in patriarchy, and that we human beings had a different way of existing at one point in time. The problem that Ian was pointing out, if you just change something, you're still within the context of the story of patriarchy, you're still there. So no matter what you do, you're still going to have the same oppression. It may be camouflaged, it may look different, but it's not really different. And then I started thinking, well, how else does our story engage? And last week, when I talked about original sin, and that the original sin was a closed system, and that original sin meant that there was nothing you could do to improve or to better yourself or to escape the negative self-beliefs that come with this original sin, and talked about some of the theologians who put that in place and how that's still intertwined in our society through the addictive process, looked at codependency and negative self-beliefs. And even though the language of original sin has changed, the oppression of negative self-beliefs has not left our culture. It's still there. So we've changed some of the words. But yet at the same time, the original sin and the other particular scripture text from the Christian tradition, it says we all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. No one escapes sin. Even though we would argue with the universality of that, at the same time, they're on to something. I mean, when we look around the world today, we see a fallen world. I used to, you know, the literature used to be it was 18,000 people a year died because they don't have health care. Now it's 40-some thousand people a year die because they don't have health care, don't have access to health care. I mean, health care is right next door, but they don't have access to health care. You know, people losing their houses, and, you know, I was, spoke at a Democratic fundraiser and did the invocation, and naturally given an opportunity to have that many people have to listen to me while there's quietness, I said, all right, this is my chance, and quoted the prophets and quoted the thing and said, you know, this is who we are as the people listen to these prophets. And one of the verses talked about people that get together at night and plan things to steal houses from people. It was written 2,000-3,000 years ago. You know, we're still doing it today, using that same formula, people meeting in secret and stealing money from people, and how that is part of the system in which we live. So it is a fallen world, and we do live in this fallen world. And when you talk about original sin and how originally that meant the world, and then they made it to individuals, they're on to something. I used to have a professor, John Patton, and every once in a while you'd say something, and sometimes the best you would get from him for a whole year would be, "I think you're on to something." And that was it. I think you're on to something. Well, they're on to something. They are pointing to something real. They are pointing to something that needs to be dealt with. And if we're going to work with the Unitarian Universalist myth, it's something we need to put in our myth to deal with what they're pointing to. We don't have to deal with it in the same way. We don't have to be so harsh with it. We don't have to create an external God as the only way out. There's nothing we can do to feel good about ourselves till we're dead and in heaven. We don't have to go that way. But we do have to deal with it. And in dealing with this fallenness and dealing with this oppression in our culture, I'm going to make a suggestion that we wrestle with, because I think this is something we can put in our myth. This is something we can put in our story that will be helpful. And it is the term universal neurosis. What is that? Universal neurosis. You know, I'm not neurotic. You know, what is the definition of neurotic? Having abnormal behaviors but still able to function. I think I got us all on that one, you know, because we all kind of have that kind of stuff. And if I think I don't have that, ask Helen. She'll tell you what they are. And, you know, that's the way it works. And we do have these acting out patterns, and we do struggle with different things we don't seem to be able to escape from. And when you look at the work, and I get this term from the philosopher Nietzsche and Freud, and my guy Karl Marx has been helpful in this thinking. And what I found out in looking at that and trying to wrestling with that, how do we develop a myth that talks about pre-patriarchy and then oppression and points to the oppression, and if there's oppression, the repressiveness, the repression that we do to ourselves and put ourselves down and have negative self-beliefs. How do we put that in our myth and make sense out of it? In reading Marx, I'm sure you've heard this term, religion is the opiate of the masses. Right, and you think about that, and you think Marx, you know, is really kind of mean-spirited and pushing, and Freud, that religion is an illusion. You know, but here's the full quote with religion is the opium of the people. Marx says, "Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the sentiment of a heartless world, and the soul of soulless conditions. It is the opium of the people." That's very different than saying Marx says the opium of the masses, and you know, we're numbing ourselves out. What he's pointing to is that there came a time in our history in which, and mostly, not the wealth of the 1,000 years before the birth of Christ. Not the wealthy, but the poorer people, the slaves, the poorer people, created this salvationist religion because they had no place to go. And in the creation of this religion, in the creation of this particular kind of religion, Marx says it was the sigh of the oppressed creature. It was a necessary thing to develop for this oppressed creature to get through time. It was important to have. It was a natural response for the human being to create a symbol system that offered hope when they lived in a soulless world, when they lived in a world that showed no care for them. It was a sigh of the oppressed creature. How many of us know this sigh when we listen to the propaganda of today, when we see that there's no hope for what we once believed was liberty, justice for all? And we do, and we do have this sigh, and we do say, people that make particular legislation, we look at it and say, how can you do that? And we see a soullessness there. We see no compassion. And what Freud said was, and again, you'd think he'd be against religion. He says the same thing. He said, no, religion was an absolutely necessary response to people in these conditions. But what he says in his thinking in the psychoanalytical theory, and when we get to universal neurosis, dealing with universal repression, dealing with that, what he says is very hopeful. He says that repression into the unconscious can become conscious. Now that's different than the religious response of original sin, that there's nothing you can do. You are a captured creature who is worthless, who is no good, and you need this external entity for you to get to a place where one day you'll be able to celebrate and have joy. Freud's saying, no. There's a repression here. There's a sigh of the oppressed creature, and it's real and it's necessary and it happens, and a human being has to do something under those conditions. But what they're saying is, there's a way out. There's something we can do. We are not helpless creatures. So what do we do if we as a religious community are reading people to say that leaving religion is the way out? And we're asking you to pledge our money to a religion that's your way out, that's going to end. What do we do? And I was thinking that listening to some poetry and some thoughts about Celtic spirituality, and that in Celtic spirituality, there's a sense in which you cannot see the world and cannot see others and cannot really experience others or really experience yourself unless it's through the attitude of love. Unless it's through an attitude of care and mindfulness, there's really no human experience other than that. And I'll read you something that I think communicates that. And I think this Celtic spirituality is a way out. And it is a religious expression, but at the same time, there is a freedom and a movement from the woundedness that we have in our unconscious that comes into consciousness, and it is within a spiritual framework. And I think this is a hint, and this gets to it. It says, on the day when the weight deadens on your shoulders and you stumble, may the clay dance to balance you. And when your eyes freeze behind the gray window and the ghost of loss gets into you, may a flock of colors, indigo, red, green, and azure blue, come to awaken you in a meadow of delight. When the canvas frays and the crotch of thought and the stain of ocean blackens beneath you, may there come across the waters a path of yellow moonlight to bring you safely home. May the nourishment of the earth be yours. May the clarity of light be yours. May the fluency of the ocean be yours. May the protection of the ancestors be yours. And so may a slow wind work these words of love around you, an invisible cloak to mind your life. And what I've recognized in Celtic spirituality is that there's a movement of poetry, of artwork, of a way of being in the world that's connected to the earth. And there's an understanding in such a way that for some the Spirit of God, for some the Spirit of the earth surrounds you in such a way that your mind moves into a direction where you only know delight, where you only know love, where you only know the pleasure of being yourself and being with others. And that there, it is like a force field, a protection, that spirituality would have you move in the direction of being in that light, of being in that space. So that when words come to you that say something negative about you, you stand and look in confusion and say, what are you talking about? That makes no sense to me. That has no meaning in my world, because I'm moving in a direction that delights in who we are as human beings. And we are delighted to live on this planet. And we honor this planet. And we honor ourselves. And we honor one another. Celtic spirituality. Celtic spirituality, very different from the Roman spirituality that has come through time with conquerors and with domination of others. In Celtic spirituality, when the spirit of Christianity moved into Ireland, it wasn't an oppressive thing. It was an invited thing where there was conversation and people didn't have to give up a way of life. They added the truth, they added the love, they added a sense of joy to what was already going on with them. There wasn't that conflict. There wasn't any conquering. There was a merger of thought of the goodness that was already there, and they took the goodness that they heard in the message and they brought it together. And today, that is what we have in Celtic spirituality. It is a sense of love, and it is a sense of delight. And when I read the seventh principle and the Unitarian Universalist principles, and when I read that, it makes sense. And I am so grateful for the feminist that added that seventh principle, because it wasn't there in the beginning, and a couple decades later it was added. Because that seventh principle includes that sense of the love of Earth and our place of belonging on this planet. So when we look for our roots, we look to the earth and we look for a place where we belong, and we belong where we are. And we can dwell in that sense of belonging. That attitude of love sees through the prison of patriarchy. And it can move us out of that prison so we can enjoy one another and build a community that's a safe haven for ourselves and for others. And that's what we're doing at this church. Building a safe haven for ourselves and for others so that we can invite others in to be with us. And that's at the heart of Celtic spirituality. And I think those attitudes, those beliefs, that way of being is something we can incorporate into the Unitarian Universalist myth. And we can begin to claim that for ourselves.